Welcome, welcome, welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm Lee Graham.
And I'm Sam Hurst.
Today we're embarking on a deep dive into The Washington Post for Saturday, September 6th, 2025. We've gathered a crucial set of articles that really hone in on the domestic landscape, exploring the interplay of policy, power, and the people right here at home.
That's right.
Our mission, as always, is to unpack these stories, sort of extract the most important insights, and help you, our listener, get truly well-informed without feeling, you know, overwhelmed by just the sheer volume of information out there.
Exactly. Our goal is to connect the dots within these domestic stories, understand their implications for your daily life, and hopefully provide those aha moments that make complex topics crystal clear.
Yeah.
We're going to explore what these headlines truly mean for you, for our communities, and, well, for the direction of our country. Let's delve into it.
Okay, let's unpack this first big theme, focusing squarely on the domestic front, where the Trump administration's policies and actions are, well, undeniably sending ripples across various sectors of our society and economy.
Indeed. And a critical starting point for understanding this landscape is the economy, which right now appears to be under significant scrutiny.
Absolutely. The latest jobs report is flashing some pretty stark warning signs. I mean, the U.S. labor market saw significantly slower job growth this summer.
Really slowed down.
In August, employers added only 22,000 jobs. That's a far cry from what economists had predicted.
Way off.
And this slowdown pushed the unemployment rate up to 4.3%, marking its highest point since late 2021.
Mm-hmm.
And to add to that, June actually saw a loss of 13,000 jobs. That's the first negative monthly reading for job growth since December 2020, you know, deep in the pandemic.
Whoa, yeah.
We're seeing job cuts across key industries like manufacturing, construction, professional services, even government sectors. And wage growth, it's cooled to a modest 3.7% annually.
And what's particularly telling here, I think, is the expert analysis. Claudia Sam, she's a highly respected chief economist at New Century Advisors, former Fed economist. She describes the job market as being at stall speed.
Skull speed.
Yeah, it's not just a technical term, right? It evokes an aircraft losing momentum. It suggests the economy is barely moving forward and has become incredibly vulnerable to a recession.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the administration, they offer a different narrative. They largely dismiss the slowdown as, you know, a temporary blip.
Right, temporary.
They're promising a resurgence, arguing that policies like tariffs and immigration crackdowns will ultimately boost domestic manufacturing, create new jobs. It's a very clear divergence in how the fundamental health and future trajectory of the economy are being interpreted.
And it seems the Federal Reserve isn't entirely convinced by that temporary blip argument either.
Doesn't seem like it.
They've been explicitly citing increased economic uncertainty, largely stemming from the president's trade and immigration policies.
Right.
So as a result, the Fed is now widely expected to cut interest rates. Not just once, but in September, October, and December.
Three cuts? That's significant.
It is. It's a significant, decisive series of actions signaling their concern. And, you know, to bring this abstract data home, the article introduces us to Leah Bailey. She's a 26-year-old college graduate.
Okay.
She applied to 200 jobs in just 4 months without receiving a single offer.
200. Wow.
Her frustration is palpable. She expressed feeling lied to as a child. I mean, her experience deeply underscores the report's findings, especially when you consider the unemployment rate for recent graduates rose sharply to 9.3%.
9.3. That's tough. And it really raises a crucial question for you listening. What does this economic landscape mean for your own job prospects, right? Your investments, the broader financial stability that affects your daily life?
Exactly.
If you're a recent graduate or maybe thinking about a career change, these figures directly impact your opportunities. For investors, well, a slowing economy, the specter of recession, these are major considerations. And the Fed's anticipated rate cuts, they will undoubtedly ripple through your personal finances, influencing borrowing costs for everything. Mortgages, car loans, credit card interest rates.
Yeah, everything gets touched.
It's a direct financial thread connecting these headlines right to your household.
Shifting gears slightly within the economic sphere, but staying very much on the domestic front, let's talk about tariffs. Because the data suggests they're proving to be a real double-edged sword for U.S. finances and manufacturing. It reveals some intriguing trade-offs.
This is where we see a fascinating tension, as you said. Two very distinct, somewhat conflicting views emerging regarding the impact of these tariffs. On one side, there's, well, a strong argument for their role in financial stability.
That's right. Global investors, who were initially quite spooked by the introduction of Trump's tariffs, they're now reportedly viewing them as a key pillar of Washington's finances.
A key pillar. Interesting.
Yeah. The reason is that this revenue stream is actually helping the U.S. avoid the worst effects of a global bond market rout.
Yeah.
Which has hit countries like the UK, France, Japan pretty hard.
Okay.
The Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, estimates these tariffs will generate a staggering $3.3 trillion in revenue over the next decade.
Oh, trillion with a T.
Right. A huge number. And this substantial inflow of funds is seen as easing worries over our public debt, which has now hit an unprecedented $30 trillion.
$30 trillion, also a huge number.
Exactly. And what's more, investors seem quite confident that the president will reimpose these tariffs even if they get struck down in court. They're essentially baking that revenue stream into their long-term financial models.
So the markets expect the tariffs to stick around regardless. That certainly presents a compelling case for the revenue-generating side.
Mm.
However, the other view, predominantly from economists, points to job losses directly tied to these tariffs. Data from the first Trump term already indicated, you know, a detrimental effect on U.S. manufacturing jobs.
Right, we saw that before.
Exactly. Economists Katie Russ and Lydia Cox, for example, they estimated that while the tariffs created maybe a modest 1,000 steelmaking jobs,
1,000,
they simultaneously led to approximately 75,000 jobs being lost in downstream industries, those crucial sectors that use steel and aluminum in their own products, like auto manufacturing or appliance makers.
75,000 lost versus 1,000 gained. That's quite a disparity.
It is. And it highlights this clear complexity. A short-term financial benefit, maybe, for the federal budget versus a direct hit to specific, often critical segments of the job market.
So you have this really intriguing dynamic.
Yeah.
Tariffs viewed by some as a necessary revenue generator, shoring up national finances, but by others as a clear job killer, particularly in certain manufacturing sectors.
Yeah.
This perceived short-term financial stability for the government seems to be coming at a potential long-term cost to specific areas of the job market.
And for you, our listener, this means tariffs aren't some abstract concept. They directly affect the cost of goods you buy, everything from, you know, everyday appliances to cars. Also, the availability of jobs in various sectors and even the stability of the national debt, which, at the end of the day, impacts everyone. Understanding both sides of this economic debate is really crucial for informed citizenship and what's becoming an increasingly complex global economy.
Definitely. Moving now from the national economic debate, let's shift our focus to the domestic landscape of policy and power. Specifically, the dynamics of federal intervention versus local autonomy. This tension is playing out in some very high-stakes scenarios across the country.
It certainly is. Let's start with what's happening in Washington, D.C., where Stephen Miller, the Deputy White House Chief of Staff, has really emerged as a key enforcer of President Trump's D.C. operation.
Right, the D.C. operation.
This is the initiative that federalized the local police department and deployed thousands of National Guard troops into the city. Miller apparently views cleaning up D.C. as a top domestic policy issue. He is reportedly leading weekly meetings, meticulously tracking arrests, including the number of undocumented immigrants apprehended.
And the White House expects this increased federal presence to continue through the end of 2026. That indicates a long-term commitment to this approach.
It does. And what's particularly striking here is the sheer consolidation of federal power over local governance in D.C. I mean, the city has its unique constitutional status that makes such federal interventions possible, unlike most other cities.
Sure.
Critics are quick to label these actions as counterproductive, potentially illegal, arguing they undermine local authority. Yet supporters, including some D.C. residents, see it as a welcome effort to bring relief to crime-afflicted areas.
Mm.
The article notes that crime rates have reportedly decreased in D.C. post-federalization, violent crime down 30%, property crime down 16%.
Okay, so there are reported results.
There are. However, this shift has also fundamentally transformed D.C. into a city, quote, primed for deportations, with D.C. police now working directly with ICE agents. That creates a very different and often much more anxious environment for many residents.
Mm. Yeah, that's a significant shift in local policing focus. This direct federal intervention in D.C. serves as a stark illustration, and it certainly sets the stage for a broader discussion of federal-local dynamics, particularly as we look just up the road to Baltimore.
Awesome.
There, Maryland's leaders are taking a distinctly proactive stance in response to what they see as federal threats.
Exactly. Maryland Governor Wes Moore, a Democrat, and Baltimore Mayor Brandon Scott, also a Democrat, they've announced an open-ended increase in state law enforcement resources to Baltimore.
State resources, not federal.
Correct. This includes deploying state troopers to state-owned routes within city limits, which strategically frees up Baltimore police to patrol other areas. This move is a direct, explicit response to President Trump's threats to send federal troops to Baltimore, a city he famously referred to as a hellhole.
Right, I remember that.
Maryland leaders are very clear. Their actions are emphatically not inspired by the president, and they aim to prevent what they call a federal occupation of their city.
It's a powerful assertion of local control, isn't it? Baltimore's proactive stance is a vivid demonstration of a city and state trying to show self-sufficiency in public safety. It's a stark contrast to D.C.'s situation, where the federal hand is so visibly present.
It really is. And it highlights the palpable political tension between state and local Democratic leaders and the Trump administration regarding urban crime and the role of federal intervention. Mayor Scott even rallied residents with a chant, "We're all we got, we're all we need." The article also captures a spectrum of resident opinions, though. From those who are surprisingly open to National Guard help, admitting that, quote, "Police don't seem to be doing very much," to others who fear increased anxiety and racial profiling, worrying about being depicted as, quote, "born to be criminals."
That's a real divide. And it raises an important question for you, our listener. How do these power struggles between federal and local authorities affect public safety, community relations, the basic rights of residents in cities like Baltimore? It's not just about crime statistics. It's about the social fabric and the fundamental autonomy of these communities.
Absolutely. And speaking of power struggles, Harvard University is currently embroiled in a significant legal battle with the administration, though they've just secured a major legal win.
A win for Harvard. Okay.
Yeah. A federal judge ruled that the Trump administration violated the Constitution by freezing over $2 billion in federal research funding to Harvard. The judge called this action an ideologically motivated assault.
Wow, strong words from a judge.
Incredibly strong language from the bench.
Yeah.
Now, while the freeze has been vacated by this ruling, the White House is already planning to appeal this decision to the Supreme Court.
So it's not over yet.
Not by a long shot. On top of that, the administration has previously threatened to take even more drastic measures, revoking Harvard's nonprofit status, denying visas for international students, even seizing patents derived from its research.
That's serious pressure.
It is. And what's particularly noteworthy here is that while this ruling is a significant legal victory for academic freedom, freedom of speech, it also unmistakably underscores the administration's broader, ongoing campaign against higher education, or at least institutions it disagrees with.
Right.
The legal battle is far from over, and the potential for further administrative actions highlights the vulnerability of even deeply entrenched, influential institutions to targeted political pressure. This case sets a significant precedent, regardless of the ultimate outcome.
Exactly. This isn't just about Harvard. It's about the fundamental role of federal funding in scientific research, the autonomy of our educational institutions to conduct that research freely, and, frankly, the dangerous precedent for political interference in academia. For you, this situation could affect the future of innovation and education across the entire country, influencing everything from medical breakthroughs to technological advancements.
Continuing on this theme of federal policies and their far-reaching impacts, we're seeing aggressive immigration crackdowns playing out in various ways. Large-scale factory raids, significant legal challenges over protected status.
Yeah, on the enforcement front, federal agents recently conducted a high-profile raid at a Hyundai factory in Georgia. It resulted in the arrest of 475 individuals.
475 people, that's a large number.
It is. The majority of those arrested were South Korean nationals. Interestingly, Hyundai quickly clarified that those arrested were not direct employees, but rather worked for various contractors that supply the plant.
Ah, contractors. That's an important distinction.
It is. And this raid occurred amid already strained U.S.-South Korea negotiations over tariffs and investments. It actually prompted warnings from South Korea's foreign ministry about potential violations of the rights and interests of their nationals, adding this whole international dimension to the enforcement action.
So if we connect this to the bigger picture, this worksite raid clearly illustrates the administration's aggressive immigration policies in action. But it also intertwines immigration enforcement with broader international trade relations, adding a layer of geopolitical complexity.
Right.
And simultaneously, on a more, let's say, humanitarian and legal front, a federal judge in California has just blocked the Trump administration from ending temporary protected status, TPS, for approximately 1.1 million Venezuelan and Haitian immigrants.
1.1 million people. Wow.
Yeah. The judge ruled that Homeland Security Secretary Kristi L. Noem illegally terminated the status without proper analysis of the dire country conditions in Venezuela and Haiti. Both places are demonstrably embroiled in profound political and economic strife.
So the court says the administration didn't follow the proper procedure or consider the conditions on the ground.
Essentially, yes. This TPS ruling represents a significant legal setback for the administration's immigration agenda, but it also highlights the ongoing legal and political battles over immigration policy and its often profound humanitarian consequences.
And for our listeners, these actions, the raids, the TPS battles, they directly impact immigrant communities, obviously. But they also have broader implications for international relations, for corporate accountability in our supply chains, and for the very legal framework surrounding immigration in the U.S. It affects our economy and society in many ways.
Mm-hmm. And we're seeing these federal threats directly impacting local community life, too, as evidenced by the situation in Chicago, where cultural events are being disrupted.
Absolutely. President Trump's threat to deploy National Guard troops to Chicago has already had tangible effects. It caused the postponement of some Mexican Independence Day parades and forced increased security measures for others.
Just the threat was enough to cause cancellations.
Apparently so. Organizers expressed real fears of raids by ICE agents, particularly with Naval Station Great Lakes, a major military facility located nearby. And what's particularly notable here is that violent crime rates in Chicago have actually dropped significantly over the past decade, according to FBI data analysis.
Yeah.
So the rationale for federal intervention isn't as clear-cut as some portray it, creating this deep sense of unease within the community.
That situation powerfully showcases the chilling effect of federal threats on local cultural celebrations. It directly links immigration policy to community life, perceived safety. It just changes the whole feeling.
Yeah.
It mirrors the situations we discussed in D.C. and Baltimore, illustrating a clear pattern of attempted federal intervention in Democratic-led cities. It's not just about law enforcement. It's about the ability of communities to gather, celebrate their heritage, and simply exist without this constant fear of federal action hanging over them.
It's a powerful point. And for you, our listener, how do political rhetoric and threats like these impact community events and the sense of security for residents, especially in immigrant communities across the country? It's a question that goes beyond policy debates and touches on, well, fundamental freedoms.
Moving to another highly sensitive and, frankly, contentious area of domestic policy, the Justice Department is reportedly engaging in controversial discussions, discussions that could have significant civil rights implications for a specific community.
Okay, what's this about?
Well, what's truly profound here is that senior Justice Department officials are discussing whether to ban transgender people from owning firearms.
Ban transgender people from owning firearms. On what grounds?
This follows a deadly school shooting in Minneapolis by an individual identified as transgender. The core of their consideration is whether being transgender could be legally defined as a mental illness under existing firearm regulations.
Wow. Defining gender identity as a mental illness for gun control purposes, that's huge.
It's a profound potential shift in how mental health and gender identity might intersect with civil liberties and Second Amendment rights. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, this move represents a significant escalation into what the Post calls divisive culture war issues by the administration. It builds on previous actions like banning transgender military service.
Right.
Legal experts are already foreseeing fraught legal hurdles and significant pushback. Not just from civil rights advocates championing the transgender community, but also from gun rights groups.
Gun rights groups? Why them?
They fear that any expansion of disqualifying mental health concerns could set a dangerous precedent for broader gun ownership restrictions impacting a much wider segment of the population. It highlights this incredibly complex intersection of mental health definitions, civil rights, and Second Amendment interpretations.
This policy discussion raises fundamental questions, doesn't it? About individual rights, how mental health is defined by the government, the overall scope of government power to categorize and restrict groups of people. It would impact not only the transgender community, but also broader debates on gun control and civil liberties for all Americans. It's a conversation that touches on very core tenets of our society.
Transitioning now, let's turn our attention to public health. We're seeing a focus on everything from frankly, confusing vaccine access guidelines to highly debated links between common medications and developmental disorders.
This area is certainly generating a lot of discussion and, for many people, a good deal of confusion. First, regarding COVID vaccine access, the FDA recently approved updated coronavirus vaccines. Okay, good news.
Mm-hmm.
However, they limited that approval to people 65 and older and younger individuals with certain specific medical conditions.
So not for everyone.
Not for everyone. And the real issue seems to be that Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s department introduced these restrictions, leading to what the Post describes as uncertainties and substantially reduced access for many. This means healthy younger individuals now face significant hurdles, like needing off-label prescriptions, and the very real possibility of their insurance not covering the costs. It creates a real barrier to getting vaccinated if you're younger and healthy.
What's particularly striking here is how this policy reflects a clear shift in federal public health guidance, potentially driven, as the article suggests, by political appointees with, shall we say, controversial views on vaccines.
Right. Kennedy's history there is well known.
Exactly. The article highlights that state-level requirements and pharmacy liability concerns are combining to create a disjointed system, making vaccine access difficult even for those who technically qualify under the new guidelines.
So even if you qualify, it might be hard to actually get the shot.
That seems to be the case. And adding to this complexity, the CDC's advisory committee, which now has new, potentially anti-vaccine members, could further complicate future recommendations. It makes the public health landscape even more uncertain for the general population.
So for you, our listener, understanding these new and often confusing rules is absolutely critical if you're seeking the updated COVID shot. It underscores the importance of proactively checking with your doctors, with local pharmacies, rather than just assuming availability or easy access.
Definitely need to check.
And it also speaks to broader concerns, doesn't it, about the integrity and consistency of evidence-based public health guidance in an increasingly polarized environment where scientific consensus can sometimes feel like it's being overridden by political perspectives.
And this politicization of public health extends to another highly debated topic, the potential link between Tylenol acetaminophen and autism. This is a conversation that is stirring considerable debate and regulatory scrutiny.
Yeah, this is truly a topic that can cause anxiety, especially for expecting parents. Conservative media and various influencers are actively amplifying new research suggesting a link between Tylenol use during pregnancy and autism.
Amplifying, that's a key word.
It is. And what makes this particularly impactful is that HHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., a known anti-vaccine activist, has made autism a key focus of his department. His agency's report, expected this month, is anticipated to mention this possibility. That's sending ripples through both the public health community and the market.
Right, we saw the market reaction.
Exactly. Shares of Tylenol maker Kenvue fell 10% on this news alone, reflecting the serious financial implications.
This topic vividly highlights the intense politicization of public health research and the rapid amplification of findings, even findings that show association rather than causation by specific media outlets and political figures.
That distinction is crucial. Association isn't causation.
Absolutely critical. The potential for a government report to elevate a debated link is significant, especially given the history of, frankly, false claims about vaccines and autism. Now, a recent NIH-funded study did find that 27 out of 46 epidemiological studies reported links, and higher quality studies were more likely to show a connection.
Okay, so there is some smoke there, perhaps.
There's association noted in multiple studies, but the researchers unequivocally stress this demonstrates association, not causation. Kenvue, for its part, firmly states no causal link has been found, pointing to leading medical groups that continue to consider acetaminophen safe during pregnancy when used as directed.
So the medical consensus hasn't changed yet?
Not according to Kenvue and major medical groups cited. It really underscores how challenging it can be for the public to discern accurate scientific information amidst these competing narratives.
So for expecting parents, this information can understandably cause anxiety. It's vital to know how to navigate it. The article wisely advises pregnant women to limit acetaminophen use, which is generally good advice anyway, but crucially, to consult their healthcare providers for personalized medical advice.
Always talk to your doctor.
Always. It truly underscores the importance of discerning scientific findings from political narratives and always seeking guidance from trusted, evidence-based medical professionals.
Okay, let's shift gears now. Moving beyond our borders and into the digital realm, we're seeing some profound shifts and, well, ongoing challenges globally and technologically.
All right, let's start with geopolitical tensions and some really concerning humanitarian crises. The situation in Ukraine continues to be incredibly volatile.
Russian President Vladimir Putin recently threatened that any foreign troops deployed to Ukraine would be considered legitimate targets. This was in direct response to U.S. and European discussions about potentially providing forces to guarantee a future peace agreement.
So escalating the rhetoric significantly.
Absolutely. Meanwhile, European leaders apparently agreed on a plan for a post-war force, which would include U.S. air support and intelligence. But this whole plan hinges on a ceasefire, which, Russia has consistently resisted.
A plan without a ceasefire doesn't mean much yet.
Exactly. Putin also made this sort of offer to meet Zelensky in Moscow, an offer Zelensky immediately dismissed as unserious. So it highlights the continued high stakes, the danger of direct foreign military involvement, and the immense difficulty in actually achieving peace. The article also notes the economic strain on Russia, despite Putin's claims to the contrary.
And for listeners, the decisions made regarding Ukraine have huge global implications, right? International security, economic stability, the balance of power. It's not just some distant conflict. It shapes global dynamics that affect you.
Definitely. And sadly, we see another devastating humanitarian crisis unfolding in the Middle East, specifically in Yemen.
Yemen's situation is dire.
It is. The country faces a worsening cholera outbreak and a broader health crisis following U.S. and Israeli airstrikes back in the spring, compounded by Trump administration aid cuts and U.S. economic sanctions. Attacks on ports and civilian infrastructure have essentially severed vital aid lifelines.
What are the numbers like?
They're grim. Yemen recorded over 50,000 suspected cholera cases and 149 deaths just between January and mid-July. It's affecting 96% of the country.
96%. That's staggering.
It's a devastating humanitarian crisis, clearly exacerbated by conflict and policy choices. The strikes, some apparently intentionally targeting infrastructure like water treatment plants, combined with aid cuts and sanctions, have crippled an already fragile healthcare system.
And the redesignation of the Houthis as a foreign terrorist organization.
That forced American aid groups to halt operations, further deepening the crisis. The article includes heartbreaking details, like an emergency room doctor in Sana'a describing hospitals as almost empty of basic drugs and equipment, and satellite images showing a rural outpatient clinic destroyed by a U.S.-led strike.
It's a stark reminder, isn't it, of the profound human cost of geopolitical conflicts and how policy decisions, even seemingly distant ones, can have life or death consequences for millions.
Absolutely. And tensions are also escalating closer to home in the Caribbean with Venezuela.
What's happening there?
Two Venezuelan military aircraft recently buzzed a U.S. Navy destroyer in international waters. The Pentagon called it a highly provocative move.
Buzzing a warship, that's dangerous.
Very. This incident followed a deadly U.S. military strike on an alleged drug vessel from Venezuela, which killed 11 people. The U.S. has intensified its feud with Maduro, whose rule it considers illegitimate, doubling the reward for his arrest and deploying warships for what they call enhanced counter-narcotics operations.
So a U.S. strike, then a Venezuelan flyby. This sounds like a serious escalation.
It signifies a dangerous escalation of tensions, raising real concerns about potential direct military confrontations in the Caribbean. The U.S. justifying deadly force against alleged narco-terrorists in international waters also raises significant legal questions.
And the potential impact for listeners.
This situation carries risks of regional destabilization, possibly direct U.S. military involvement, with potential impacts on international trade routes, energy markets, and regional security. It's another volatile spot to watch.
Okay, shifting from geopolitical hotspots to global environmental challenges. There's new research challenging a key climate solution, burying carbon.
Right, carbon capture and storage, or CCS. A new study in the journal Nature suggests Earth's total practical carbon storage capacity is significantly smaller than previously thought.
Smaller. How much smaller?
The estimate is down to about 1.6 trillion tons from a previous, much more optimistic estimate of around 13 trillion tons. That's a huge reduction.
What does that mean in terms of temperature goals?
It means this limited capacity might only allow us to cool the planet by about 0.7 degrees Celsius using this method, far less than the maybe overly optimistic 5 degrees Celsius projected by some earlier models relying heavily on CCS.
So CCS isn't the silver bullet some hoped for.
The study argues strongly against using this finite geological storage resource for ongoing fossil fuel emissions. Instead, they say it should be reserved solely for removing carbon already in the atmosphere, the legacy emissions.
That really challenges a key assumption in many climate change mitigation strategies.
It does. It highlights the urgency of reducing emissions now rather than relying too heavily on future carbon capture technologies. It also notes, pointedly, that U.S. spending on cutting emissions and storing CO2 has been slashed under the current administration.
The lead author, Matthew Gidden, is quoted saying, "It puts a ceiling on how high we can go and still reduce temperatures back down to the long-term temperature goal of the Paris Agreement." That's pretty clear.
Very clear. And for you, this directly impacts the long-term outlook for climate change and the strategies needed to protect the planet. It raises serious questions about the realism of some current climate goals and the urgency required for emissions cuts.
And we're seeing the immediate, devastating impacts of climate change right now, tragically, in Pakistan.
Yes, Pakistan's northern mountain retreats, traditionally escape zones from the intense summer heat, have become deadly flood zones due to climate change. Over 800 people have died this year already, the highest toll since the catastrophic floods of 2022.
What's causing this transformation?
It's a combination of factors, all amplified by climate change. Decades of deforestation, increasingly intense monsoon rains, and accelerated glacier melt causing sudden glacial lake outburst floods, or GLOFs.
GLOFs. Those sound terrifying.
They are. Sudden, massive releases of water from melting glaciers. This is a vivid, tragic example of climate change's immediate and devastating human impact, particularly in vulnerable regions. It highlights how climate change isn't just about rising average temperatures, but about extreme, unpredictable weather events and the destruction of ecosystems.
And the economic impact.
Significant, especially in these tourism-dependent areas. The article includes harrowing personal stories, a tour guide recounting a cloudburst turning a stream into a raging river, killing 13 people, a family having to tear down their home because of glacier outburst floods.
These stories really bring the abstract concept of climate change down to a very personal human level. It shows how it directly threatens lives, livelihoods, entire communities right now, globally.
Absolutely. Now let's move into the digital frontier. Some big developments in AI and social media.
Starting with AI and copyright. There's been a landmark settlement involving the AI company Anthropic.
Yes. This is significant. Anthropic will pay $1.5 billion to settle a class action lawsuit brought by book authors and publishers.
$1.5 billion. Why?
The claim was that Anthropic improperly downloaded millions of copyrighted books to train its AI models, like Claude. This is the first and, by far, the largest copyright recovery of its kind in the AI era, and it avoids a potentially messy trial.
It's a big win for creators.
It's seen as a significant victory for human creators in this rapidly evolving legal landscape around AI. It sets a major precedent for how AI companies might need to compensate for copyrighted material used in training their models.
What about other AI companies?
This could definitely influence similar lawsuits currently pending against Google, Meta, Microsoft, OpenAI, all the big players. The settlement emphasizes that while training on copyrighted works might fall under fair use in some contexts, taking legal or ethical shortcuts, as the article puts it, will likely face serious consequences.
So for you listening, if you're a creator, an author, an artist, this is a big deal for protecting your work in the age of AI.
Absolutely. And if you use AI tools, it speaks volumes about the ethical foundations, or perhaps the lack thereof, upon which some of these powerful tools are being built. It's about ensuring fairness as this technology develops.
Sticking with tech giants, there are renewed concerns about protecting young users, specifically on Meta's platforms.
Yes, researchers found what they're calling a loophole in Meta's Instagram accounts designed for teens users 15 and under.
A loophole? What did it allow?
It apparently allowed these young users to access violent and gory content, including things like dogfights and school brawls, simply by searching specific tags, like the word fight. The platform's content warnings often disappeared after the initial searches, making repeated access easier.
Dogfights and brawls accessible to under 15s. That's disturbing.
Extremely. Meta disputed the term loophole, but they did admit that some violating content was present and hadn't been removed quickly enough. This reignites long-standing concerns about social media's impact on youth mental health.
It echoes past whistleblower claims, doesn't it? That Meta sometimes prioritizes engagement and profit over user well-being.
It does. And it highlights the ongoing challenges of effectively enforcing safety protocols on these massive algorithm-driven platforms and the potential for severe psychological effects on adolescents exposed to harmful content.
So for parents and young people listening, this is a critical reminder of the ongoing risks of online platforms. It underlines the need for constant vigilance and, frankly, better protective measures from the companies themselves.
Definitely. But there are also efforts emerging to address some of the downsides of AI, particularly around privacy, and also initiatives focused on AI education.
Okay, like what?
Well, on the privacy front, the search engine DuckDuckGo now offers a chatbot feature called Duck.ai. It allows users to access technologies like ChatGPT, Claude, and Llama, but with more privacy guardrails.
How does that work?
DuckDuckGo essentially acts as a middleman. It limits what the AI companies themselves know about the users and their conversations. Crucially, these conversations are not used for training the AI models, with some minor exceptions, and they're only saved anonymously for a maximum of 30 days.
So a privacy-focused way to use these popular AI tools.
Exactly. It offers a practical solution for people concerned about AI data privacy, highlighting a growing demand for user control in this space.
And the education initiative.
First Lady Melania Trump is leading something called the Presidential AI Challenge. It's a competition for K-12 students to solve community problems using AI.
Interesting. What's the goal?
It's framed as part of her longstanding interest in online safety, but also about preparing the workforce for what she calls an AI-driven economy. She describes AI as a moment of wonder and the greatest engine of progress.
Moment of wonder. That's quite a positive framing.
It is. The DuckDuckGo initiative offers a practical tool for privacy-conscious users. Melania Trump's involvement brings a high-profile, if maybe somewhat abstract, focus on AI education for youth, potentially shaping future policy and curriculum. Her comment about needing watchful guidance for kids using AI is particularly notable given the issues we just discussed with teen accounts on Instagram.
Right. The irony isn't lost there. So for you listening, if you use AI, the privacy implications are direct. Duck.ai offers an alternative.
And if you have children, the conversation around AI education is shaping their future. These two stories offer different facets of navigating this rapidly evolving AI landscape.
Okay, now for a slightly different pace, let's explore some of the more human interest stories, cultural insights, and of course the latest in the world of sports from the Weekend Post.
Sounds good. Let's start with faith, art, and personal choices. There's a fascinating story about an LGBTQ+ pilgrimage to Rome.
A pilgrimage? To the Vatican.
Yes, an improbable LGBTQ+ pilgrimage, as the Post calls it. It was actually sanctioned initially by Pope Francis, and it's proceeding now under the new Pope Leo IV for the Holy Year Jubilee.
So it's still happening under the new Pope.
It is. Over 1,300 LGBTQ+ Catholics will participate in a Vatican-sanctioned prayer vigil and mass. They'll even pass through the sacred holy door at St. Peter's Basilica. Apparently, the event was temporarily removed from the official calendar after an internal leak caused some controversy, but it's back on.
What's Pope Leo IV's stance? Francis was seen as more open.
That's the interesting part. Pope Leo IV has reportedly offered strong private support for the event. However, his public views on homosexuality are less clear. He has previously criticized positive depictions of the homosexual lifestyle, so there's some tension there.
So a private welcome, but maybe public ambiguity.
Seems like it. This story is a powerful reflection of the ongoing tension and the evolving dialogue within the Catholic Church regarding LGBTQ+ inclusion. It highlights Pope Francis's legacy of outreach and the challenges Pope Leo IV faces in balancing tradition with a more inclusive approach. For the participants, it's described as a watershed moment of acceptance and visibility.
The article follows individuals too, right?
Yes. People like a historian who does nightclub drag but also attends mass devoutly, and a transitioning trans woman seeking courage from her faith. It features quotes from Innocenzo Pontito, president of Jonathan's Tent, the group that petitioned the Vatican, and Bishop Francesco Savino, who expects Pope Leo to surprise us.
It's a deeply personal story about how large institutions grapple with modern social issues, personal faith journeys, and that universal quest for acceptance and belonging. It resonates whether you're Catholic or not.
Absolutely. And sticking with culture, there's controversy brewing over art at the Smithsonian.
The culture wars reached the museums.
It appears so. The Trump administration has attacked a 2020 painting by Rigoberto A. Gonzalez titled Immigrants Crossing the Border Wall into South Texas. It's hanging in the Smithsonian's National Portrait Gallery.
Attacked how?
They called it art, in quotes, and divisive content. This seems part of a broader administration campaign targeting content it deems woke or anti-American, focusing squarely on the message and ideology rather than artistic merit or technique.
What's the painting actually like?
It shows a family descending a ladder from a border wall. Gonzalez explicitly draws inspiration from Baroque art and Christian iconography. Think Flight into Egypt, the Deposition of Christ. It includes details like a crumpled newspaper with a Trump impeachment headline. The artist himself references Rembrandt and Caravaggio as influences.
So, using classical techniques to depict a contemporary politically charged scene.
Exactly. The work challenges the administration's narrative about the border. The criticism highlights this broader distrust of realism, representation, and empathy in art, particularly when it addresses the experiences of marginalized communities.
This story really invites you, the listener, to consider the power of art, doesn't it? Its power to provoke, to inform, to challenge, and how different ideologies attempt to control cultural narratives. It also highlights the importance of engaging critically with artistic interpretations of social issues.
Well said. And from public art to very private family dynamics, there's an advice column letter that touches on some common conflicts.
Dear Carolyn Hacks, what's the dilemma?
A woman is separating from her first marriage after less than 3 years. She's receiving scathing judgment from her father, who has been divorced 3 times himself.
Oh, the irony. What's his criticism?
He insists she hasn't tried hard enough, and he seems worried she'll jeopardize her chances of having a child if she leaves this marriage now.
Thrice divorced dad judging his daughter's first separation. That's a complex.
It touches on deeply personal and, frankly, very common family conflicts, especially around big life choices like marriage and divorce. It highlights the complexities of inherited patterns, unsolicited advice, and the immense pressure individuals often face regarding personal timelines for life events like having children.
Yeah, many listeners will probably relate to navigating difficult family conversations, setting boundaries, and dealing with projections from others about their own life choices. It's a reminder about self-respect and making mindful choices for yourself, even when facing judgment.
Indeed. Okay, let's pivot to the weekend sports wrap-up.
All right, what's happening in sports?
First, in the WNBA, a look at a legend and a team's current struggles. Sylvia Fowles, one of the greatest centers in WNBA history, is being inducted into the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame.
Fowles, a true great. Multiple MVPs, championships, Olympic golds, most rebounds ever.
Exactly. But the article highlights her profound humility. She was known for focusing on dictating the game, not the narrative around her, and for making others feel seen. Just a quiet, dominant force.
A class act.
Definitely. On the other end, the Washington Mystics' lengthy losing slide has officially put them out of playoff contention.
Ah, tough season for the Mystics.
It is, but the silver lining. It improves their draft lottery odds. And rookie Kiki Iriafen has been a bright spot, setting a single-season team record with 16 double-doubles, showing a remarkable consistency despite the team's struggles.
So Fell's story is about quiet greatness and values. The Mystics situation shows the ebb and flow of pro sports losing now might mean future gains via the draft, and individual achievements can still shine through.
Precisely. It reveals the human element, dedication, values, the strategic long game of team building.
Okay, what about tennis? The U.S. Open just wrapped up.
Big news there. Novak Djokovic lost in straight sets to Carlos Alcaraz in the semifinals. It was his first hard court loss to Alcaraz.
Djokovic losing. That's still news.
It is. And it's his third consecutive Grand Slam semifinal loss to either Jannik Sinner or Alcaraz. The article suggests this might indicate a widening gap at the very top of the men's game.
The young guns taking over.
Possibly. But interestingly, the New York crowd, which hasn't always warmed to Djokovic, was surprisingly rooting for him this time. He was seen as the underdog against Alcaraz, making him, quote, more lovable in defeat.
Even Djokovic becomes the underdog eventually. A look at the twilight of a legendary career, perhaps, and shifting fan perceptions.
Could be. And in women's doubles, Gabriela Dabrowski and Erin Rutliff won the title, beating Taylor Townsend and Katerina Siniakova. Dabrowski's win is particularly significant, her first major triumph since undergoing breast cancer treatment.
Wow, that's an incredible comeback story. Resilience personified.
It really is. Taylor Townsend's tournament was also marked by a reported post-match altercation with an opponent, adding a bit of drama to the doubles scene.
So, tennis gave us stories of legends facing challenges, incredible resilience after adversity, and even some off-court drama. It reminds us, sports aren't just about winning, but about these powerful narratives.
Exactly. Quick hits on baseball and football.
Sure. What's the local buzz?
The Washington Nationals' modest three-game winning streak ended with an 11-5 loss to the Cubs. Pitcher Jake Irvin struggled early. On the bright side, Dalen Lyle hit two triples and Luis Garcia Jr. hit a two-run homer.
Okay, a bump in the road for the Nats. College football.
The Maryland Terrapins moved to 2-0 with a solid 20-9 win against Northern Illinois. The defense looks stout, allowing only 16 points total in two games. Freshman QB Malik Washington had a mixed performance, some mistakes, but ultimately decisive.
Good start for the Terps. Any NFL insights?
A look at the Pittsburgh Steelers. They had a wild offseason, right? Signing veteran QB Aaron Rodgers, trading for stars DK Metcalf and Jalen Ramsey. Big moves.
Huge moves. Going all in.
They are. But the article is skeptical, suggesting this surprising evolution might still not be enough to get Coach Mike Tomlin his first playoff win since 2016. It predicts a familiar pattern, a rapid demise in the postseason.
Ouch. High-stakes gamble in Pittsburgh. It reflects that broader trend in pro sports' aggressive roster changes chasing that championship.
It certainly does. A compelling case study in team management. And finally, just a few Metro local crime briefs.
Okay, quickly.
Two 17-year-olds charged as adults in the fatal shooting of Eric Tarpinian Jockim, a congressional intern here in D.C. A third suspect is still at large. U.S. Attorney Jeanine Pirro used this case to advocate for more federal authority over juvenile criminal matters.
Tragic story. Next.
A man identified as being in the U.S. illegally, Hugo Hernandez Mendez from Guatemala, was charged with murder in the death of Dakara Thompson, 19, in Prince George's County. County Executive Aisha Braveboy criticized federal authorities for releasing him after a prior DUI arrest, touching on immigration enforcement policy again.
Local impact of broader policies. Anything lighter?
Yes. The Metro Richmond Zoo announced the birth of 6 cheetah cubs, one of its larger litters. Always nice to end on some cute animal news.
Always. So these briefs cover local crime concerns, touching again on immigration, criminal justice policy debates, and a little bit of joy from the zoo. Local news impacting communities directly.
So looking back at our deep dive into the Washington Post for Saturday, September 6, 2025, we've really seen how the domestic landscape is being reshaped by these ongoing policy battles.
Yeah, from the struggling job market and those complex tariff debates.
To the heated discussions around immigration enforcement and federal intervention in local affairs in places like D.C. and Baltimore.
And we also explored the challenges in public health, the confusing vaccine guidelines, the unfolding Tylenol autism debate, and how information gets amplified.
And then globally, we navigated that complex web of geopolitical tensions, Ukraine, Yemen, Venezuela, alongside the urgent realities of climate change, both the limits of potential solutions like carbon capture and the devastating impacts we see in Pakistan.
Right. And in the tech world, copyright clashes with AI, serious concerns for young users online. It highlights this critical need for responsible AI development and better platform safety.
Even while Melania Trump's AI education initiative signals a national focus on preparing for a future where, as she put it, the robots are here.
And we even touched on those very human stories, faith and identity in the LGBTQ plus pilgrimage.
The intersection of art and ideology at the Smithsonian.
And those personal dramas playing out in advice columns about family and life choices.
And of course, a quick look at the weekend sports, celebrating legends like Sylvia Fowles, and analyzing team prospects from the Mystics to the Steelers.
It's clear that from our economy to our environment and from our digital lives to our personal choices, we're in a period of intense change and ongoing debate.
Which raises, I think, an important question for you to ponder as we wrap up. As we see more and more areas of our lives become politicized, from how we fight crime to how we talk about art, even how we assess public health information, what is the impact on our ability as a society to find common ground and actually solve these really pressing issues that affect all of us?
That's definitely a thought to take with you. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive.
Until next time, stay curious.